This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
When I was 14 or 15 and first read Henry James' sentences, the sentences in his late, great, ornamental style, they seemed to promise something very important, which was that complexity was real. Part of our suffering in adolescence is the misfit we feel between the infinite intricacy of our inward lives and the bald summary that seems to be on offer outside. We think we may be mad or lost in a dream while everyone else is awake. Ordinary common sense language just isn't adequate to what an adolescent feels, which was why late Henry James was reassuring, even if I didn't understand the half of it. His style was like a proof that there really was more to things and the relations between things than plain speech could do justice to. What a relief. People and situations really might be as unfathomable and richly interesting as they were in his pages. Listen to this from The Golden Bowl, James' last completed novel, published in 1904. Here's the story so far. The prince and Charlotte are in love, although he's married to Maggie Verver and Charlotte is married to Maggie's father, Adam Verver, so that Charlotte is Maggie's stepmother, although she's only Maggie's age. It isn't only the style that's intricate. The plot twists elaborately around itself like the frame of some foxed old Baroque mirror. The prince is Italian and the other three are American. They live for the moment in England. The Ververs are very rich. The affair between the prince and Charlotte seems to be unconsummated thus far. Now the lovers have their opportunity. They're away together at a house party at Matcham, a grand country house for the weekend, while Maggie and her father stay at home in London. Charlotte and the prince can escape from their hosts and, with the help of the railway timetable, have a whole day to themselves in Gloucester, which rather wonderfully becomes, in the novel's incantation, Gloucester, Gloucester, they say, the enchanted scene offstage of their fulfilment where we can't follow them. The twists and turns of history, what's become of the real streets of the real Gloucester, say, since 1904, add a new level of yearning and mystique to the original, which the author could never have foreseen. Here, the prince is waiting on the Matcham terrace in the morning, and Charlotte is looking down on him from the window of her room. What, in fact, most often happened was that her rightness went, as who should say, even further than his own. They were conscious of the same necessity at the same moment, only it was she, as a general thing, who most clearly saw her way to it. Something in her long look at him now out of the old grey window, something in the very poise of her hat, the colour of her necktie, the prolonged stillness of her smile, touched into sudden light for him all the wealth of the fact that he could count on her. He had his hand there to pluck it on the open bloom of the day, but what did the bright minute mean but that her answering hand was already intelligently out? So, therefore, while the minute lasted, it passed between them that their cup was full, which cup their very eyes, holding it fast, carried and steadied and began, as they tasted it, to praise. One of the things I love about James' style, just one of them, just to begin with, is his way with commas, or rather, without them. Death-dealing commas, he called them, and so rightly. The comma is the commonplace policeman of punctuation, too often insisted upon as if writing were machinery and the commas the little cogs that made all the grammatical parts grind together correctly. Whereas James uses it as a musical indication for phrasing for the voice. It's exquisite that there's no comma in the whole of, but what did the bright minute mean but that her answering hand was already intelligently out? You can feel editorial pencils itching to make a clarifying pause like a schoolteacher's after mean or quarantine off intelligently inside a pair of commas stern as handcuffs. Of course, let's be practical, the comma can help often with establishing sense. But the movement of thought isn't like cogs in a mechanism. It's more like the flow of water. The comma as a piece of punctuation is anti-Baroque. It imposes the tight circle of grammatical sense on the energetic asymmetry of meaning inside the sentence. Let's go back to that first part of the first sentence. What in fact most often happened was that her rightness went, as who should say, even further than his own. James' late style is lavish in those kind of colloquial disclaimers. As who should say, he amused himself by declaring, it was to be said, at any rate. There's something utterly distinctive in the way his sentences sound, showy, self-conscious, excessive, confiding. Lots of readers hate them, not surprisingly, just because they sound like that. There's always the bustling, insistent voice of the book preventing us from hearing straight through the voice into the story. The voice is not a transparent medium. In late James, the medium isn't transparent. The medium is the thing itself, like the Baroque frame which changes everything reflected in the mirror. The not ordinary story only comes into being as it finds expression in those not ordinary words. Her rightness went, as who should say, even further than his own. But how extraordinary to name rightness as a personal quality and then imagine it going a distance and then imagine one's rightness outdistanced by someone else's, a lover's, who is always ahead where your rightness leads, waiting there before you. James's prose locates and names the intangibles which other writers leave between the lines. The intimations that flash under our conscious thoughts are his substantial subjects. And what is the prince's rightness, by the way? Isn't what he and Charlotte are about to do, committing a particularly convoluted adultery, she's not only not his wife, she's his mother-in-law, rather obviously wrong? Well, the whole novel is an extended and labyrinthine exploration into whether our judgments of right and wrong are founded in anything real at all, and if they're real, whether right and wrong are fixed categories or fluid ones. It's a recurring mystery, James' novels want to remind us, that individuals, some few individuals, really do know how to act out with grace and grandeur the roles they pick up in whatever great social drama of their time. They know how to live. Some readers might need convincing that a tiny hothouse tale of privileged adultery is a great social drama, but that's for another occasion. This knowing how to live is his subject matter in the late books. It interests him immensely. He's also interested in those opposite types who believe they haven't known how to and have missed their chance, like Lambert Strether in The Ambassadors. The prince doesn't miss his. He has his hand there, James writes, on the open bloom of the day. It won't last, this love affair. Maggie will find them out and manoeuvre to separate them and grow up in the process. And then, when she's changed, the prince will find his wife too interesting to stay faithful to his lover. Charlotte will be exiled to live with her husband in America, along with the rest of his collection of fine works of art. She and the prince will never get back to Gloucester. But then, nothing lasts. And in the short time that we have, it's a gift if you can know the open bloom of the day when you see it and to have the audacity to pluck it, along with the right rare companion who sees it too and is there with her railway timetable before you. What did the bright minute mean but that Charlotte's answering hand was already intelligently out? As who should say? Who should say? Whoever in real daily life might ever say anything as extravagantly mannered as James does in that passage and in the whole of his book? To whom does he mean to confide his story? James writes as if for a select elite of people in the know, participants who understand the game. But did such an audience ever actually exist? Aren't the transactions and conversations he writes like transactions and conversations no one on earth ever had? James invents an aristocracy of initiated listeners, sophisticated and ironic and super subtle, capable of following his twists and turns. That's like no aristocracy really was in 1904 or at any time. And this quixotic effort gives his prose its melancholy. And how could his late style have spoken so strongly to me in the 1970s of a Labour government and reggae music and the bomb and feminism and all the rest? His high style brings a dream of form into being, like the carved gilded surround of a mirror which changes forever what's reflected in it. We rise to the occasion, seeing ourselves, not quite distinctly, in the foxed glass at the centre of the frame's gilded excesses, its opulent digressive sentences, its long lines of meaning, its signature curlicues. Were there Baroque experiences before artists dreamed up a Baroque style? Once James had invented the possibility that the world might be imagined in this way, the way was open to anyone who chose it. When I first read his late style, I seemed to recognize it, as if I'd always known about the things he knew about, but without having a language to describe them. Energies that had been inchoate in me could now find form. James' excess and his high manner aren't ornamental. Or rather, it's the soul of Baroque style that ornamentation isn't an extra or a superfluity. It's of the essence. The complication, the intricate effort, the sheer excess of expression, these are the story, reassuring us that we'll never get to the bottom of anything. There is no underlying plain truth which style decorates. Without its frame, the glass in the mirror isn't a picture. It isn't anything.
The essay was presented by Tessa Hadley and produced